Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Monday, March 28, 2016. There was another terrorist attack, this time in Pakistan. A breakaway faction of the militant Taliban group in Pakistan claimed responsibility for an Easter Sunday bomb attack. This was on a park in the eastern city of Lahore. It killed 65 people and wounded over 300. A spokesperson for the group says a suicide bomber with the faction deliberately targeted the Christian community. He warned that more attacks would follow. Police said the explosion took place close to the children's rides in the park, which was crowded with Christian families celebrating Easter. Deanne Penn reports.
The Gulshani Iqbal Park reportedly was filled with families who were out celebrating Easter when the bombing occurred on Sunday evening. Many of the victims were women and children. The UN Secretary General has called for those responsible for the bombing to be brought to justice. In a statement issued by his spokesperson, Ban Ki-moon expressed his heartfelt condolences to the victims and their families. He urged the Pakistani government to do its utmost to implement measures to ensure the personal safety of all citizens, including religious minorities. The president of the UN General Assembly has also issued a statement expressing his dismay over the incident. Mearns Lykketoft said targeting innocent people, including families, showed an utter contempt for humanity. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
In Belgium over the weekend, 13 raids took place linked to the investigation into last week's deadly attacks. Amid international criticism of the country for serving as a base for extremist fighters, including those who launched the November attacks in France, the Belgium government is admitting some shortcomings in its fight against terror. The country's interior minister says Belgium's justice system and security services are lagging behind, this after decades of neglect. Today, Turkish President Erdogan accused Dutch and Belgian authorities of incompetence for not taking action against İbrahim el-Bekraoui, despite Turkish warnings that he was a foreign terrorist fighter. El-Bekraoui later turned out to be one of the suicide bombers at Brussels Airport. The Turkish president accused European authorities of ignoring Turkish requests that people flagged by Turkey be prevented from traveling out of their countries. He says European countries are still allowing fighters to travel to Turkey and Syria. He said this was their way of seeing things. Their names linked to terror organizations should go to Turkey, to Syria, or Iraq, and do whatever they want to do as long as they don't carry out any acts on our soils. Today, Muslims rallied in support of Brussels victims. They held a rally outside the Maelbeek metro station to show solidarity with victims of last week's bomb attacks. They walked to the station, which was hit by a suicide bomber. They carried colorful signs which read, "Salam, hey, no violence, all united against terror."
Enlever une vie, c'est enlever la vie de l'humanité entière. Nous sommes tous unis. Nous sommes tous là. Nous sommes tous ici.
And then they release colorful balloons into the air. In Damascus, a Syrian city that's famous for its 2,000-year-old ruins is back in the hands of the Syrian government. Troops recaptured the ancient city of Palmyra on Sunday. This was with the help of Russian airstrikes, scoring an important victory over Islamic State fighters who waged a 10-month reign of terror there. It's still not clear just how extensively the militants destroyed the city's monuments. Initial footage on Syrian TV showed widespread rubble. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Fidel Castro responded today to President Barack Obama's historic trip to Cuba with a long, bristling letter recounting the history of U.S. aggression against Cuba. He wrote, "We don't need the empire to give us any presents." The 1,500-word letter in state media titled "Brother Obama" was Castro's first response to the president's three-day visit last week. In it, he said the American president had come to bury the two countries' history of Cold War hostility Obama didn't meet with the 89-year-old Fidel Castro on the trip, but met several times with his 84-year-old brother, Raul Castro, the current Cuban president. Obama's visit was intended to convince the Cuban people and the Cuban government that a half-century of U.S. attempts to overthrow the communist government had ended, that the U.S. was allowing Cuba to reform its economy and political system without the threat of U.S. interference. Fidel Castro writes of Obama, "My modest suggestion is that he reflects and doesn't try to develop theories about Cuban politics." In other news, a former president of Honduras has admitted to taking bribes in the wide-ranging FIFA soccer scandal. Rafael Cuyeja, a member of the FIFA's Television and Marketing Committee, pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges today in federal court in Brooklyn. He told the judge he accepted bribes and distributed some of the money to others. He said he knew it was wrong. Cuyeja was president of Honduras from 1990 to 1994. Closer to home, a mock tombstone for Donald Trump has been removed from New York City's Central Park. The grave marker displayed the name Trump below a cross. Below that, it read Donald J., with the Republican frontrunner's birth year, 1946, and the year of death left blank. It also displayed the phrase, "Make America Hate Again," a mocking send-up of the Native New Yorkers' campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again." Parks Department officials say today that workers hauled away the realistic tombstone. Officials say it wasn't clear who erected the tombstone. It sat on a grassy lawn in the park just a few blocks from the Trump International Hotel and Tower. The celebrity businessman's campaign did not immediately respond to a request for comment. And today is Moral Monday. The minister known for starting the movement and the former minister of the Riverside Church in New York say they will go on a 15-state tour to encourage people to reclaim political discourse so it focuses on love, justice, and mercy. The Reverend William Barber and the Reverend James Forbes are calling the tour the Revival Time for a Moral Revolution of Values. It begins this Sunday at Riverside Church. Barber says the social political process has been poisoned by regressive, immoral, and hateful policies, and that people of faith and others must work towards equality and peace. Barber is president of the state chapter of the NAACP, but he says he's speaking out on this tour as minister and founder of a group called Repairers of Breach. Mexicans celebrated the Holy Week with rituals of burnt effigies of Donald Trump. Anthropologists say burning effigies serves a symbolic function to overcome divisions and unite communities around a common enemy. And this year, with his anti-immigrant views and racist hate speech in some of Mexico's poorest neighborhoods, residents united around the burning of a grinning replica of New York's billionaire real estate developer, replete with a red tie, blue blazer, and tuft of blonde hair. The burning is part of a widespread Mexican Holy Week tradition where neighborhoods burn effigies to represent Judas, who betrayed Jesus. Trump, who created a divide in the Republican Party with insiders trying to stop his nomination, continues to debase the presidential campaign dialogue along with Ted Cruz, whose banter has fixated on their wives. Here's Bernie Sanders.
These Republicans, let me tell you, are not just an embarrassment for the American people. They are an embarrassment for sane Republicans. Can you imagine, with all of the crises that this country faces, a disappearing middle class, income and wealth inequality, all of the other problems, what they are spending their time on are attacking each other's wives? How crazy is that?
On Saturday evening, Sanders supporters got a powerful psychological boost. This when the Democratic presidential hopeful swept caucuses in Washington State, Alaska, and Hawaii by wide margins. And Sanders says he expects to close the delegate gap with Clinton as the contest moves to liberal northeastern states, which includes New York. On Friday evening, a funny thing happened. Many are saying it's symbolic. Here he was delivering a speech in Portland, Oregon.
I want every kid in Oregon and Washington and Vermont to understand that if he or she does their schoolwork seriously, does well, takes school.
Then attention shifted to a songbird.
What?
Oh. Thousands watched. And so did Sanders, waving to the bird, as is his nature.
Now, you see, this little bird doesn't know it. Oh, my.
Then the bird flew onto his lectern.
I think there may be some symbolism here.
Then Twitter lit up with the hashtag Bernie Sanders.
I know it doesn't look like it, but that bird is really a dove asking us for world peace. No more wars.
Here in New York State, lawmakers are in Albany with Governor Cuomo negotiating the final New York State budget, which is due this Thursday. They are looking at several possible compromises over the governor's proposal to enact a $15 minimum wage. The sticking point is the phase-in time for the hike and what the difference in time should be between New York City and upstate New York. Cuomo wants to gradually raise the wage from $9 to $15 over 3 years in New York City and over six in the rest of the state. Other ideas include exempting farmers from the wage or temporarily halting scheduled increases if an economic downturn occurs, and of tying a wage hike to the rate of inflation. The $15 wage is one of Cuomo's top priorities for the year. Recommendations to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour for fast food workers was passed by the Wage Board in June. Recently, the governor established the Mario Cuomo Campaign for Economic Justice, this to raise the wage statewide to $15 an hour. Workers, labor advocates, and faith leaders are holding a vigil at the New York State Capitol in support of Cuomo's proposal to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Meanwhile, there was a win for NYU students. The administration of the university announced it's raising the minimum wage for campus workers to $15 an hour. That brings it in line with Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo's efforts to raise the wage for state and city workers. Oliver Arnoldi spoke with NYU students.
A stone's throw from the NYU campus in the Village, I sit down for coffee with Katie Shane of the NYU Labor Movement, and she is all smiles.
We won 15, you know, to be the first private university in the country to do this is a huge deal.
15 is the campaign led by Shane's group to raise the minimum wage of NYU undergraduate student workers from $9 to $15 over the next 3 years. Next year, the minimum will be $12. And it's a decision that's making plenty of students happy.
I think it's beautiful. I love it. It's a good idea.
I'll be happy to get $3 more an hour than I used to, so I'm not complaining at all.
That's freshman Kaylin Hayes and junior Al Gilardi, who work together on the circulation desk in the basement of NYU's BOPS library. But upstairs, not everyone's completely satisfied, like Ravina Vakil.
It's like, oh, we're getting a wage increase. It's going to be awesome, but it's going to take 3 years for it to get to the $15. So I just think it could be done a little faster.
The NYU raise comes in the middle of a bigger push by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to raise the state minimum wage to $15. But back at NYU, Shane sees the struggle of her university and that of other activists across the city and state as sharing common missions.
Our campaign wouldn't have worked if we hadn't had the support of workers in the community. And so we're going to support them till they get what they need as well.
Oliver Arnoldi, Columbia Radio News.
In other news from Columbia University Radio, New York City public advocate Tish James is suing the city's Department of Education to force it to improve services for more than 100,000 special needs students. James found that 40% are not getting services that are required by state law. One of the problems is with CSIS, the DOE's $130 million data tracking system. Gilda DiCarli reports.
Megan Moskop is a special ed teacher at MS 324 in Washington Heights. She has a caseload of 17 students, each with an individualized education plan, an IEP. That plan is supposed to spell out exactly how the school is going to meet the students' educational needs. But here's the issue. Too much teaching time is spent on record keeping, and that's where the city's troubled special ed data program comes in. It's called CSIS.
Every time I hear that word, I just get, like, palpitations and shivers down my spine.
That's how many special ed teachers feel, according to Moskop. And here's why. It just doesn't work.
I clicked on the service. Error. I clicked on the subject. Error. I clicked on the frequency of service. Error. I clicked on the location. Error. I clicked save and continue. And another error.
If you've ever wanted to toss your computer out the window because nothing seemed to work, well, that's CSIS for you. It's not supposed to be that way, though. CSIS was designed to track the progress of students with special needs, progress that the DOE is required by law to monitor. It's failing, which is why public advocate Letitia James has sued the city. The goal of the suit is to compel the DOE to disclose how it intends to fix the problem. And
the failure of the system has been one of the department's worst-kept secrets.
Teachers say the educations of tens of thousands of New York City public school kids are being shortchanged. Special education technology is Jonathan Isaac's domain. He founded a data program called Wonder, which has had a lot of success being implemented in school districts in Texas. Isaac is now hoping to expand Wonder from his new office in Newark. As he looks across the river at New York, he says there's just no excuse.
New York City is certainly a very large and complicated school system. But what you'll find is that the challenges that they're facing in regards to IP, data tracking, and data systems are not necessarily unique to New York.
And what's worse, the city may actually be losing money it could have gotten from the federal government through its Medicaid reimbursements program, the healthcare program that pays the state back for services it provides to the disabled. The city's independent budget office released a report on the CSIS problem 2 weeks ago. The report's author, Yolanda Smith, says the issue is simple.
If you can't track and monitor what children are getting services and what types of services they're getting, you also can't go back and say, hey, we'd like to be reimbursed for paying for those services, because we're really talking about millions of dollars that have to come from somewhere.
Millions of dollars that have to come out of the city's own pocket. So I ask Yolanda Smith, do we need to replace CSIS?
You know, on the one hand, we've really put in a lot of money for CSIS. It's been at least $130 million. So that's a lot of money to just walk away from. The question might be how much more money should we put in to make it work.
And that's precisely the question that public advocate Letitia James's lawsuit hopes to answer. Her office declined to comment, but oral arguments are scheduled to begin sometime next month. Jill DiCarli, Columbia Radio News.
In other New York news, New York is putting an end to most paper prescriptions for medicine as the nation's toughest electronic prescribing law takes effect. As of yesterday, doctors, dentists, and other healthcare professionals must electronically send prescriptions directly to pharmacies instead of giving paper scripts to patients. There are exceptions for emergency and unusual circumstances, and thousands of prescribers have gotten extensions. The law aims to fight painkiller abuse by thwarting prescription slip forgery while reducing errors by eliminating sometimes hard-to-read handwriting. What's known as e-prescribing has grown nationwide in recent years. Many patients, doctors, and pharmacists find it time-saving and helpful, but some New York medical leaders have expressed qualms about requiring e-prescribing in almost all situations and about the law's penalties. They include the possibility of fines, license loss, or even jail time. Meanwhile, advocates for seniors are urging lawmakers to add at least $15 million in additional funding to help low-income New Yorkers age safely at home. Andrea Sears reports.
Low-income seniors need help to stay in their homes. That's the message their advocates want lawmakers to hear as they finalize the state budget. They may be the most neglected seniors in New York, says Bobby Sackman with Live On New York. They have too much income to be on Medicaid, but not enough to pay for the support services they need. Sackman says there are 10,000 older people across the state who are on waiting lists for a variety of services.
For Meals on Wheels, for case management where a social worker comes into their home, for home care, for transportation, for adult day services, and the list goes on.
Live On New York has joined with AARP and others in calling for an increase of at least $15 million in state funding for community services for the elderly. Those services help not only the seniors, but family caregivers as well. Richard McGee's 95-year-old mother, who has been approved for a home health aide, has been on a CSE waiting list for 3 months.
It makes it more and more difficult for me because she's more dependent on me every day. And so I spend much of my time during the day over there trying to help her with just her daily needs.
In the past 3 years, the waiting list for CSE services have increased by 3,000 seniors. the percentage of New Yorkers over age 65 continues to grow, while the ratio of potential family caregivers is going down. Sackman calls access to affordable elder care a 21st century workforce issue.
Just as we've talked for decades about the need for affordable child care, we need to look across the lifespan, and the other side of that equation is how do you help these men and women stay in the workforce and balance their lives?
Sackman says the proposed $15 million increase in CSE funding has bipartisan support in the legislature, but the Senate's proposed budget would increase it by only $3 million. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And as we've been reporting, the City Council passed two of Mayor de Blasio's housing bills last week. MIH, Mandatory Inclusionary Housing, and ZQA, Zoning for Quality and Affordability. Major wins for the de Blasio administration, says Ben Max of Gotham Gazette. He tells us the City Council was happy to pass these bills with some tweaks.
The Mandatory Inclusionary Housing Program, which mandates affordable housing be built in new developments in rezoned areas of the city, passed by a margin of 42 in the affirmative and 5 in the negative. The Zoning for Quality and Affordability, which is largely aimed at creating new senior affordable housing, but also changing some of the land use rules around how buildings are built, building sizes, adding additional heights, that one passed 40 in the affirmative, 6 negative, and 1 abstention. There were 4 city council members absent from the vote. Now, the mandatory inclusionary housing policy is the first of its kind in New York City, and many are saying the most aggressive and progressive in the nation. Whenever new housing capacity is approved through a rezoning, whether it's for a whole neighborhood or just a plot of land or a block, now any development that comes on that land will have to fit into one of 4 formulas that the City Council passed today for including affordable housing within the unit. And that means that there will be certain caps on rents of units based on family income and ensuring that families are not paying more than 30% of their income on their housing costs. This is a threshold for being rent burdened. There is a huge rent burden crisis around the city, with many severely rent burdened, which means paying 50% or more income on housing. The mandatory housing program includes different formulas. An example of one is 25% of the housing units, however big the building might be, 25% of the units set aside for those making about $47,000 a year as a household of 3. And there are a few other options that go a little bit up or a little bit down from there. But the gist is that a certain number of units are set aside in new developments at certain rent thresholds. This is the de Blasio administration putting new rules in place to harness development in the city and ensure that with new market rate development, there is always affordable housing that comes with it. On the zoning for quality and affordability front, you're dealing with a lot of smaller aspects of the zoning code that are also very important, and things around parking requirements that come with new development, as well as the first floor heights of new buildings that are often used for retail space, increasing those height allowances to make the retail space more attractive to tenants. The key next steps for the mayor's housing program are, how will the mandatory inclusionary housing policy play out? Affordable units are only going to be built if developers are building, and the city is relying on the fact that New York City has a very hot housing market. They're also trying to get ahead of development in new neighborhoods, citing what has happened in places like Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant, where there haven't been such strong rules in place and gentrification has swept through neighborhoods, forcing many tenants out. The idea behind the new program is to create enough new affordable housing units to house many longtime residents, as well as some new people moving in from other neighborhoods. The administration is also pairing these efforts with aggressive preservation efforts, whereby they are trying to keep many, many thousands of units that are already under rent affordability guidelines in those programs. For WBAI, this is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
Mm-hmm. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, March 28, 2016. The news was produced with Gilda DiCarli, Oliver Arnoldi, Ben Max, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.